Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA Podcast. Before we get underway, just a few reminders. You can find us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find all three of our Twitter handles as well, so be sure to give us a follow. You can check us out on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe, to download, to leave us some reviews. We'd love to hear any feedback you have. And this year, we're being hosted on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports. And for the NBA-centric content, at FanRagNBA. This week, I am joined, as always, by Sarah Chalea. How's it going, Sarah?
It's going all right. I gotta apologize if it sounds like I'm dying, because I might actually be, but nobody be alarmed. It's all good. How you been?
I'm good. I think I might have somehow passed my cold to you through the podcast last week, so I apologize about that. Our third trusty co-host, Morten Jensen, cannot join us today. He is off gallivanting in Rome on his honeymoon. Really, he just knew we were going to talk about Derrick Rose, so he fled the country. But he will be back next time. And I think we need to really start there with Derrick Rose, because that was the weirdest and biggest news of the week, to say the least. Just some background for those who were not aware or on Twitter Monday night. Derrick Rose shows up to shoot around that morning. All is normal. He's listed as a starter that night. All of a sudden, the Knicks cannot find him. He does not show up to the game. They try to contact him during the game. They can't reach him. A couple of Knicks reporters and Andrew Wojnarowski are kind of tweeting breathless updates throughout the game, just saying like the Knicks have no idea where he is. Turns out, it sounds like he went back to Chicago. He said he had a family situation that needed to be tended to right away. He said he didn't answer the Knicks' calls because he needed, quote, space. So that was weird already. Frank Izzola of the New York Daily News said Rose was, quote, an emotional wreck, and his, quote, state of mind was such that for a brief time, he talked about walking away from basketball for an extended period of time to clear his mind. So, we still don't know what's going on with his family. We don't want to speculate about that. I think we can all agree that, you know, family always comes first. We praised Drew Holiday earlier this year for taking time off and praised the Pelicans for letting him do so. So we're not going to, you know, crap on Rose for taking time off for a family situation. That said, I think we can agree he probably should have called the team and let them know what was going on. But this begs the question. Rose is only signed through the end of this year. According to ESPN.com's Ian Begley, he is expected to pursue a max contract this summer, which would be in the range of 5 years, $150 million. So, Sarah, what do you think the Knicks should do here? How should they proceed with Derrick Rose?
Well, for right now, you know, you just kind of move forward. You know, they find him, and I think everybody's trying to move on from whatever happened. But, you know, and like you said, we don't want to get into it that much because it all sounds very personal and very human, honestly. But like you said, ideally he would have let them know, like send a quick text or email through his phone or something. But I certainly can understand wanting to disappear. As long as it's not a routine occurrence, you hope that the people who care about you and work closely with you can understand and forgive that once. But I think it probably is one of many things that contributes to an uncertainty about his future in the league or with the Knicks. Or, you know, I think it's kind of sad that it came out that, you know, he was possibly thinking about walking away from the game, because I think anybody probably goes through moments of considering things like that, but you'd kind of like to keep it all, you know, close to the vest. Obviously, I don't think anyone's going to offer him a max, and he's probably going to be interesting to see where he goes from here, you know, especially, like I said, with that coming out, that he may have thought about that, who's going to want to commit to him long term. So that's probably the biggest question.
Yeah, I think that really is the big question, because, you know, we've talked about this a lot, you know, in previous podcasts about how rich the point guard position is across the league. So it's not like there aren't that many teams that need an answer at point guard, first of all. And then with all of the issues that come with Derrick Rose, particularly his injury history, you know, it's tough to rely on him as a long-term answer, especially at that kind of money. So I think, you know, when this Begley report circulated earlier this week, everyone saw it and was just like, oh yeah, I'm pursuing a max contract too. I would like to also be paid $30 million a year. So I think it's safe to say he will not be getting that no matter where he goes. The question really is, you know, should the Knicks stay with him, or should, you know, should they be willing to re-sign him at any price, or, you know, should this incident coupled with his relative ineffectiveness this year just cause them to say, you know what, you know, we're moving on, we don't want you back at any price. It's worth noting, you know, since his one game sabbatical, he's actually played pretty well in the two games since. You know, he kept them competitive in the loss against the Sixers on Wednesday, and then helped them rout the Jimmy Butler-less Bulls on Thursday. So he is showing flashes of, you know, I don't want to say like his vintage self, but he is showing flashes of 80% of his old self, somewhere around that.
Got some kind of effectiveness is always good.
Yeah, yeah. So it's certainly a tough situation for the Knicks moving forward. You know, I think, frankly, I think if they can find a taker for him at the trade deadline, if a team is like really desperate and thinks he's the answer that can help push them over the top, they'd be crazy not to pursue that. I don't know if they're going to get that lucky, but it's definitely, you know, something worth considering in the next month or so before the February 23rd trade deadline. So let's now move on. You know, last time we talked about Paul Millsap a lot, because right around then was when ESPN.com's Mark Stein and Brian Windhorst reported the Hawks were shopping him, along with Kyle Korver, who we will discuss briefly in a bit, and Thabo Sefolosha. This past week, the Vertical's Adrian Wojnarowski, I think it was on Monday, reported that the Hawks are no longer shopping him. They said they were taking him off the trade market and informing teams that he's not available. According to ESPN.com's Ong Yongmisuk, they also have informed Millsap that he will not be traded. So do we think this is actually the end of the Millsap trade speculation, or is it a ploy from the Hawks to drive up prices, you know, coerce teams basically to say, okay, you know, teams have done this before, basically, where they say, you know, we're not getting the offers that we are, the caliber of offers that we want for this player. We're taking him off the market. And then 3 weeks later, a team will be like, all right, we're desperate. We'll throw in an extra first round pick, or we'll throw in an extra prospect. And then he's right back on the table. So where do you fall on that spectrum? Do you think he's truly not, zero chance of him moving before the trade deadline, or are the Hawks just trying to convince teams to give up a little bit more?
I don't know what the Hawks are doing, but I would say the door is closed, but it's not locked, probably. You know, they're probably going to keep that open, just kind of see what they get offered, but it's just weird, you know, that the Korver trade seemed to signify that they were just going to tear everything down. Of course, I understand just trying to see what, you know, get something for him at that point, but it's hard to believe that that was the best option, was, you know, to give him to the top team in your conference for not a lot. Apparently they wanted Dunleavy, but I don't know. But I did say last time that I hoped to see Paul stay, so if that ends up being what happens, then I'll be happy about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be, you know, ideal, if only because the Hawks are still a competitive team. You know, I think there's an argument either way. So the one side says, you know, they're not going to beat Cleveland this year, and Millsap's a free agent, so what's the point in spinning your wheels in a way? Mm-hmm. But if Millsap really wants to stay there, you know, this is what we said last time. It comes down to what Millsap is telling them behind the scenes, basically. If he's saying, I want to stay there, I'm going to re-sign with you long term, you know, I'll even give you a hometown discount, maybe. You know, I'm not just in it for the money, I'm not going to take the highest offer. Then if you're the Hawks, I think you kind of have to keep him, because he's still a great player. You know, he's still, we said it last episode, he's still a top 20 NBA player, even though for whatever reason, every time his name comes up in trade speculation, people on Twitter are like, oh, why would you trade anything of value for Paul Millsap? Paul Millsap's really freaking good, man. So yeah,
they do the same thing with Jimmy on Twitter.
I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I've been, obviously, we follow a bunch of Chicago people. So Jason Pat of Fanbag Sports was sparring recently with a guy who would not trade. I think he wouldn't trade Jaylen Brown straight up for Jimmy Butler. So therein lies the value of discussing trades on Twitter. There is none. But
the age thing is overblown, don't you think, though? Because that's what a lot of it is with Jimmy. And it's like, I get it, but at the same time, you know, I'm a Spurs fan, so, you know,
we've
had guys who've been effective well into their 30s,
right?
So
you're used to, I mean, your Westworld robots work a lot longer than the rest of the leagues, but yeah, not every player ages gracefully until he's 39, true. Only in San Antonio, but I mean, that's the same holds true for Millsap in a way. Like, he's, I think, 31 or 32. So, you know, again, it's kind of the windows of contention thing. But, like, you also just signed a 30-year-old Dwight Howard for 3 years. So if you were that concerned about going all in on a youth movement, you're not going to re-sign, or you're not going to sign Dwight either. The Hawks have won 7 straight. They're, you know, 4th in the East. They have a 2.5 game lead over the Bucks, Pacers, and the Hornets for the number 4 seed. So I think it kind of depends what happens in the next couple weeks with them. If they hit a big skid and they suddenly don't look like they are going to make the playoffs, maybe they make a move. But I'm with you. I kind of think if Millsap is telling them that he wants to stay there, and, you know, from all accounts he does, then unless you're absolutely blown away with an offer, I don't think you sell him for 60 cents on the dollar just to make a move. I don't think there's a point in that. If he's going to re-sign there, great. You know, I get that they're worried about what happened with Al Horford happening again with Millsap. But if he's saying he's not going to do it, at a certain point, you just have to take him by his word and understand that the circumstances of last summer are very much a one-time anomaly. The cap is never going to spike that high that quickly. You know, you're never going to be able to create a super team like the Warriors overnight, that kind of thing. The Hawks, we talked about them with Millsap and why they shouldn't trade him. That said, they did actually make the first move of the trade season last Friday, I believe, is when the news came out. They traded Kyle Korver to Cleveland for Mo Williams, who is effectively retired, Mike Dunleavy, and a 2019 first-round pick. We need to give a shout out to Cavs GM David Griffin, because he continues to just make something out of nothing. It's frankly incredible that he's able to continue loading this team with valuable pieces, even though they're, you know, beyond capped out. And for this trade, he flipped picks with Portland. Cleveland owed Portland their 2018 first. He instead sent them their 2017 first, so they could then be eligible to trade a 2019 first rounder. Because of the Stepien rule, you can't trade first round picks in back-to-back drafts. So ESPN.com's Brian Windhorst has a really good story about David Griffin and just kind of how they keep asking him to conjure these crazy deals to round out the core, and he keeps doing it. So shout out to him for that. Sarah, what did you think of the Korver trade? Did you like it from the Cavs' perspective, from the Hawks' perspective, from both, or from neither?
Obviously, it's a pretty good deal for the Cavs. He had kind of a rocky start. He's still Korver, that is, integrating, which is to be expected, but he's getting loads of open shots, which we all knew he would. There are some questions about defense, but they'll work that out. It's a good trade for them. For the Hawks, I didn't like it. I'm somewhat coming around. I think they, you know, they've been called Spurs East. I think they're trying to take a guy like Dunleavy and flip him into, you know, and he's been a productive role player before. It's not like he's nothing, you know, he's been productive. It's been a while, but I feel like he could be a good player for them, a good role player. So maybe it works out pretty well for them too. You know, maybe they were going to lose Korver anyway, and now they get a productive guy who's a similar type player, and they get a pick. So, hey, it could end up working out for both teams.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of right with you where I think it's a good move for both sides. You know, Cleveland obviously getting a guy like Korver, you know, just a career, I think, 42% three-point shooter, putting him next to LeBron and Kyrie and just feeding him open shots. You know, his shooting percentage was down this year, but a lot of that was due to the type of shots he was taking. He was a lot, you know, he had to create more off the dribble because Dennis Schroeder was not providing him the same looks mm-hmm. that Jeff Teague did, and then Dwight Howard's not the passer that Al Horford was. So, you know, you're Spurs East. The Hawks haven't been as fluid because they've been integrating new pieces, you know, whereas that, you know, that core from a couple years ago where consistent Eastern Conference Finals challengers. I think Korver, LeBron, I love his quote. He's just like, every time he touches the ball, he needs to shoot. Mm-hmm. Like, he just has the permanent green light. So I think he's going to be a great fit. He's going to be, defensively, you know, he's a 36-year-old guy. He's not going to provide much on that end, but I think his offensive contributions will hopefully outweigh whatever minus he has on defense. But for the Hawks, too, I like it. I mean, you know, they shouldn't trade Millsap because they could re-sign him, and he's not that old, relatively speaking. I mean, Korver's going to be 36 soon. They just drafted two wings in the first round this past year. They also have Tim Hardaway Jr., who's been playing well in the last couple weeks. So in that sense, I think they kind of just wanted to get younger on the wing. And maybe that gets Kent Bazemore going. He's been, sneaky bad this season, and they just signed him to a huge deal this past July. So I'm guessing this move was made, I don't want to call it addition by subtraction, because Korver's still a good, productive player, but I think they just needed to get more time for their young guys. And, you know, that 2019 first-round pick, as long as LeBron James is still standing, it's going to be pretty low. It's going to be in the 25 to 30 range. So, you know, you can't expect much out of that. That said, Jimmy Butler was the number 30 pick. You know, Rudy Gobert was 27. You know, it's a crapshoot. The draft is a crapshoot already. It's a super crapshoot when you get into the late first round. But if you find a productive player there, that's going to be one of the biggest steals in the league. So you can only hope that, you know, at that point, you're just trusting your scouting department. But even still, Korver, there's a decent chance he was leaving for nothing in the summer anyway. So turning him into any asset of even, you know, moderate value is better than losing him for nothing. So bravo to both sides. No real gripe there. So we need to now talk about DeMarcus Cousins. On Saturday, ESPN.com's Mark Stein reported the Kings were offering or planning on offering him a $200 million, $207 million extension via the new designated player exception that we talked about a few episodes ago that is part of the new collective bargaining agreement, barring a late change of direction. So James Hamm of CSN Bay Area reported Boogie is planning on signing it, barring a late change of direction, which we don't know what that means. Tom Ziller of SB Nation, basically, he has a good article, so look him up if you want to read more about the Boogie Kings extension and why it kind of makes sense for him to do it. But basically, the new CBA, the financial side, makes it now significantly more appealing for a player who qualifies for this designated player exception to sign an extension versus test free agency. It's a difference of upwards of $60 million. So this begs the question, do we think that these reports are valid? Do you think that Boogie is going to stay in Sacramento long term? And should he?
Well, I was somewhat surprised when I heard that he was planning on signing it. But I probably shouldn't be, because, like you said, like people like you and me can't even fathom the idea of being offered $200 million for right. anything. So that I'm sure that would be hard to resist. It's interesting to me, this whole, you know, with the new CBA. I'm interested to see how it plays out, because, yeah, I understand wanting teams to be able to hold on to their stars, especially teams in those markets that aren't, you know, Los Angeles and New York. But I don't know. It's going to be, like, you know, that's been talked about somewhat on Twitter already, too. I think Ethan Strauss, who's out in the Bay Area, has talked about, you know, is that great for the league to have these star talents languishing kind of in these, you know, teams that aren't going anywhere. That'll be the question, mm-hmm. you know, if Sacramento continues to be underwhelming as a kind of a franchise or a front office, is that good, you know, if Boogie stays? And all we can do is wait and see. And the good thing about it is that, you know, the league seems to be open to, you know, obviously there's no perfect solutions, so they're trying things, and if, you know, it doesn't work out, they're just going to look and see what happens, and they're open to changing it up. And the good news is that the Players Association and the league brass seem to have a good relationship at the moment, and they can compromise, so hopefully that continues.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm with you. When I heard it at first, I was more surprised than I probably should have been, just because mm-hmm. it seems like the writing has been on the wall for a while that Boogie is going to bounce in 2018 yeah. when he becomes a free agent. That said, you said it well. Like, I could not, if someone handed me a paper that said you can make $207 million over the next 5 years, I would have a very hard time turning that down. You know, I've seen it framed on Twitter in, like, the sense that, you know, we always say, like, oh, well, he's still going to make $130 million. Like, it's still life-changing money either way. But if your boss offered you, like, $13,000 or $20,000, which one are you going to take? You're obviously going to take $20,000, even if you,
yeah.
you know, if you hate your job, you're still going to take the extra $7,000. So, in that sense, I get it. You know, I think you hit on the big point, and as a Sixers fan, obviously, I'm happy that the league has made it yeah. easier to retain your stars, especially, you know, the homegrown ones, because that will be an issue for the Sixers over the coming years, with Embiid, with Ben Simmons, with whoever they add as their lottery picks, knock on wood, plural, this year. So, you know, the fact that it's going to, teams have more advantages in terms of retaining their stars, I like it personally, selfishly, but I think you raise a very valid point. Like, is that good for the health of the league to have, you know, a frustrated Boogie, you know, just languishing in Sacramento and putting up 28 and 12 every night, but, you know, being stuck on a 30-35 win team? Or if, you know, I don't want to say Anthony Davis is heading down that road, but, you know, so far at least, the Pelicans haven't really constructed a well-rounded core around him to really exploit his particular talents. So if they continue down that path, you know, Paul George has expressed frustration this season about how he's, like, not having fun playing basketball anymore. Yeah. You know, do you want Paul George stuck in Indiana? So I think it's definitely a balancing act, because you don't necessarily want every superstar flocking to 4 or 5 you know, local destination teams. But you also, you know, it sucks to see these guys who are, I don't want to say wasting their primes, but, you know, nothing is coming. They're not having playoff success, at least. Like, mm-hmm. they're putting up huge numbers, they're getting all-star appearances, but, you know, they're nowhere close to winning a championship. So it's definitely something to monitor as we move forward, especially over these next couple of years and how we start to see the new CBA playing out. But yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens with Sacramento. I was just I just did a roundtable for the Step Back about kind of about the New York Knicks, and I came up with a scenario. You know, they asked like who the Knicks' best long term asset was, and I said Carmelo because it only takes one desperate team to make a trade for him to get something in return. And I had this like this horrible vision. Can't you imagine this summer? When Rudy Gay leaves in free agency, the Kings are like, you know what? We need one more guy to convince Boogie to stay. We're going to trade Willie Cauley-Stein, Kosta Koufos, who's the other one? Oh, Aaron Aflalo, and like a lightly protected first-round pick for Carmelo.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine it.
Yeah, so I, you know. We'll see what happens in Sacramento this summer. I think it's going to be very interesting either way. I don't believe Boogie becomes eligible to sign that extension until July, so maybe he waits to see what happens with the draft and with free agency before making any rash decisions either way. But it sounds like, Kings reporters, you better get used to Boogie because it sounds like he is sticking around long term. And speaking of which, if anyone missed it, after this news broke, he then interviewed a couple reporters in the locker room, and it's fantastic. You should definitely be sure to go watch that on Twitter or YouTube, because he's basically asking reporters if they want him to stay around, reporters who he has a contentious relationship with, and one of them literally says no.
They weren't enthused,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I was reading the articles that, you know, you mentioned, and it's like I didn't even realize he's been there for 7 years already, and he's, I think they said he's about to pass Peja Stojakovic for number two all-time scorer. Mm-hmm. It's like, you do feel like you, I know he's really good, but you feel like you're missing a bunch of his career because he's stuck in Sacramento.
Right.
But, I mean, the counter-argument is that, you know, they have a chance to make the playoffs this year after, you know, waiting it out for how long. The West is finally somewhat open, that last spot, you know. Them and the Pelicans, you mentioned Anthony Davis as well. So
that's true. Yeah. They just needed the perfect confluence of events where no one wants to win the eighth seed. And then they're right in the mix. Way to go, Kings. Good strategy. We could touch on this next thing briefly, but we'll also get Morton to weigh in when he comes back. Last week, Bleacher Report's Rick Bucher reported Jimmy Butler is on the trade block, quote, for the right price. He said the Bulls, quote, have been uncertain about building around Butler, even after signing him to a huge deal. For what it's worth, ESPN.com's Mark Stein and The Athletic's Sean Hyken both refuted the report, and CBS Sports' Matt Moore also had a really good column about why the Bulls are not going to trade Butler. Sarah, do you think they should trade Butler, or do you think they're actually seriously considering it?
They may be considering it. There again, you know, I don't know what that... We've heard Morton rail about the Bulls front office right. quite a bit. Honestly, I don't think they should. I probably shouldn't base it off of what I see on Twitter from people who apparently don't know Jimmy's value, but it just seems like they're not going to get what he would deserve, you know, what he would garner.
Yeah.
So I would say hold on to him. And as far as having reservations about building around him, I think the small glimpses we've seen this year of what that might look like should alleviate any of that.
Yes.
There's no reason not to, especially, like you said, they've already given him the deal. Just go all in. Mm-hmm. You know, no guts, no glory on that one. He's played really well, and he doesn't even have, you know, a lot of shooting around him. Imagine if he did. So right. Just give him the keys, and, you know, you have a really good talent. Just, you know, ride him.
Yeah.
Let him be the star.
Yeah, I think Morton last episode was saying, you know, imagine him as in the Harden role, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, imagine him as the full-time point guard. Like, I'm with you. I think unless they get blown away by an offer, they should not trade him. Whether they will or not is another question. But, you know, the past couple games have shown they suck without Jimmy Butler. They are mm-hmm. just, like, a depressing, bad team. They are, like, the 2015-16 Sixers. Like, they're just not even fun to watch. So I think, you know, the Bulls front office is concerned with ticket sales and with merchandise and with being considered, you know, a legitimate force in the East, whether they are or they aren't. They want to have that perception, which is why they signed Rondo and why they signed Wade. So unless you can get a deal, I mean, Denver is frankly the only team, maybe Boston if Danny Ainge actually decides to ever trade any of his real assets. But Denver is the only team where I think, you know, if you're going to trade Jimmy, I think you're going all in on a rebuild. Like, you're not, you don't want to be spinning wheels and trade Jimmy for another star caliber player in his late 20s. Like, that's why the Boston thing is a little less appealing to me. You know, like, Matt Moore had a column today where he proposed some ideas of Boston trades, and I think he had, like, Jimmy and Nico for Avery Bradley, Jay Crowder, Amir Johnson, and I want to say Terry Rozier, maybe, plus the 2018 Nets first-round pick, which is unprotected. And that's, like, on paper, that's a pretty fair trade, but, you know, Bradley and Crowder are already they're not going to be aligned developmentally with the young guys that you're going to want for Jimmy. So I think, like, that's where Denver stands out. If you can convince, you know, we talked about this a couple episodes ago where Nuggets fans refuse to put Nikola Jokic in any deal for Jimmy Butler, which is absurd because you don't get to trade for someone else's best player without including your best player. But if you could get a Jimmy deal structured around Jokic, now we're talking, because that's a guy who's super young but also has, like, that superstar upside. So, you know, I don't know that they would find a deal like that, but that's the kind of thing I would be pursuing if I were the Bulls and I was serious about trading Jimmy. So now let us go into our deep dive section. Last week we hit on a bunch of the top Eastern Conference contenders. So Sarah, this is your week. It's the Western Conference. We're going to start with the Clippers, who were 20-8 before Blake Griffin had his little knee surgery. They have gone 7-6 since. They are still sixth in both offensive and defensive rating, and Chris Paul is leading the league in ESPN.com's real plus minus by a country mile, I think by more than 2 points. So he is, yeah, he's playing out of his mind, and it's going under the radar, as usual with Chris Paul. So the question with the Clippers, I think, is, do you think Blake's return is going to fix whatever's been plaguing them lately? And are they a legitimate threat to the Warriors in the West? You know, not, we'll have to just forget that game in December where they got yeah. waxed.
That's really the question, isn't it, regarding Blake? As I think, you know, obviously Chris Paul is playing great basketball, and we're used to that from him, and Blake, you know, we've seen them be successful in the regular season without Blake, but I really believe that in order for them to have any chances in the postseason, he's got to be that MVP caliber guy that he's been for flashes of, like, the last 3 years, but, you know, he's had so many injury problems. If he can get back to that, they can be a big threat. There's a chance that all of this works out okay, and they, you know, they come back together, and they're somewhat fresh, and they peak at the right time. You know, that's always the goal, is just be playing your best basketball when you really have to. And, you know, I don't want to overreact to that game, like you said, but I do think we can't quite put them up there as a contender with the Warriors at the moment, just because they really have yet to prove it. You feel like, you know, they can compete, but they just always fall a little short, you know. So they're going to have to at some point go out there and beat that team mm-hmm. before I think we can jump on that ship. But, you know, I think you and I both picked them to be second in the West, and they kind of fell apart earlier than usual, than we expected.
Yeah.
But I still think they have a chance to be that threat that we all saw. And they've kind of been like the sleeping dog, you know.
Yeah.
They've fallen under the radar because of Blake being out, and then Chris was out for a little while as well.
Right.
So I think that makes them even more dangerous, because I do think we kind of forget about them. I was surprised to see that they're still, you know, what, six, you said, in offense and defense?
Yeah.
So, you know, even without Blake and with CP being out, in and out. So, yeah, they're still very dangerous. They're still very good. It's easy to forget about it.
Yeah. But. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think you phrased it well that they're kind of the sleeping giant that, you know, because Houston has been playing so well,
yeah,
and came really out of nowhere, I think they've kind of been the talk of the town outside of the Warriors. So, you know, Clippers are just kind of, they're trudging along. They lost six straight. They've now won five straight. So it seems like they've gotten their legs back under them, at least since Chris Paul came back. You know, I was going to mention this later, but we might as well touch on it now. Kevin Garnett just joined the Clippers as a consultant as well. Says he's not going to travel with the team or be on the bench, but he's going to occasionally help out at practices. And my favorite thing about this story was when DeAndre Jordan was asked about his new role. He said, "Amazing, amazing, amazing. Besides him cussing me out, we played against each other." So I think, you know, I don't know how much he's going to be around the team or how much he's going to help, but I feel like the Clippers need that like cagey nastiness to them, especially when they're going up against the Warriors. Like, it seems like they have this monkey on their back when it comes to that team where they just can't get over that mental hurdle. And I feel like a homicidal maniac like KG is going to help them, you know, kind of get past that and be like, all right, we are, you know, maybe we don't have the talent of this team, but we can beat them, and we, you know, we're not scared of them. I think we talked about that an episode or two ago. You know, how the fear of the Warriors is really thwarting teams from actually beating them. But you just, like, you can't go in and be afraid of them, and it feels like the Clippers are. So I'm interested to see how the KG consultant role, what, if anything, it does and what impact it has. But I do think it would be wise to at least consider the Clippers, you know, I'm not going to say they're going to beat the Warriors because they, you know, they need to prove it first, but they're at least a threat, and they could conceivably make the finals if everything broke right for them. We just talked about Houston briefly, but let's go a little further in depth with them. You know, prior to Wednesday's loss against Minnesota, they had won nine straight. They are 20-3 since beating the Warriors in double overtime on December 1st and have the league's third best offense. This is my weekly chance to jab you and Morton. You guys gave me crap for putting James Harden as my preseason MVP. Oh, lo and behold, he's a legit MVP candidate. One might say he's even the front runner. While Mike D'Antoni, you know, he probably is the coach of the year front runner, if not for, I feel like David Fizdale in Memphis is the only other real threat to him right now. Daryl Morey, hell, he's probably the executive of the year right now, because he brought in D'Antoni, brought in Eric Gordon, brought in Ryan Anderson, and made the decision to move on from Dwight Howard, which really seems to have fueled this kind of shocking rise for the Rockets. So what do you think is kind of fueling Houston this season? What has made them turn into such a monster? And is it sustainable over the second half of the year?
Well, I was looking at the stats site on NBA.com a little bit. And I wanted to see like how many guys they have in the top of the catch and shoot attempts.
Uh-huh.
And they have Eric Gordon is number four, behind Clay and Kevin Love and Dirk, although Dirk has only played 13 games.
Okay.
He's got like, what, 6.5 catch and shoot attempts a game. Trevor Ariza is ninth with 5.9. Ryan Anderson 13th, 5.7.
Wow.
And the really awesome thing about it is that you have to go in and look at the numbers, because the attempt, that's their field goal attempts, catch and shoot. But then for each of them, the 3-point catch and shoot field goal attempts is like a tenth of a percentage point less. So they're all pretty much threes.
Right.
You know, and so they each shoot, like Eric Gordon's at 39%, Ariza 39%, Ryan 42.9%, but their effective field goal percentage is like 59, 59, and
63.9. Jeez.
Because they're, you know, it's all threes. So, you know, what it comes down to is they have three guys accounting for 7 catch and shoot made threes per game on like 21 points on like 17.8 attempts. So that's ridiculous. And that's, you know, you're not even accounting for your superstar James Harden, who's like one of the top scorers in the league. And then you got, you know, the role men, you know, Capella and Harrell, and they have Nene, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and Decker, who's a young athletic guy, who's kind of a wild card. So, I mean, all that to say, I think that it is sustainable in the regular season.
Okay.
I'm interested to see how it works out in the playoffs, because they really are all in on this, you know, we're just going to score more than you, and we're either going to stop you enough, or you're just going to be inefficient enough at your type of game that we're going to win.
Right.
And I don't know that that's going to work out for them. I really think it comes down to kind of those role guys being a threat,
mm-hmm.
because I think, you know, if you make a decision, maybe it's a calculated risk, and it sounds insane, but if you make the decision of, we let Harden beat us, we don't overreact to him, and we don't leave the shooters.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's an interesting strategy, but they do have those dangerous role men who, you know, on that pick and roll, it's not easy to just say, okay, well, we're not going to overreact to James, because you got guys diving to the basket. So, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, they definitely are a threat. But I still think I would put them below even the Clippers, if the Clippers get healthy and get to where they're rolling, which remains to be seen. But and the Spurs and the Warriors, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're 19th, I want to say, in defensive rating. So, as you said, their strategy is basically, like, we're just going to outscore you. Which, you know, we haven't, especially against the Warriors, we haven't seen that as the sustainable strategy for success. When the Warriors and the Cavs have battled, it's really been, we're going to play really tough defense on you, and we're going to make your life hell. And by game 7, you're going to be worn down enough that you don't want to, you know, your legs are going to be tired. They do have, I mean, Ariza is still a plus defender. Pat Beverly is a great defender and also perhaps a little dirty. So in a 7-game series against Chris Paul or against Stephen Curry, they do have that. You know, that said, Harden, he's not as bad defensively as he was last year. Still not, you know, above average, elite, anywhere in that level. I think he's passable. Same goes for Ryan Anderson, Eric Gordon. You know, Clint Capella's hurt right now, but he'll be back, I think, in a couple weeks. So he'll provide some nice rim protection, but you still definitely have some glaring defensive minuses that you have to worry about in a 7-game series. I think you're right that in the regular season, they're just going to cruise to 55, if not 60 wins. You know, I'd be surprised, frankly, if they were not a top 3 seed going into the playoffs. I am interested to see how that translates, whether a team, as you said, kind of decides to sell out to stop the shooters and just let Harden get his 50, but don't let them bomb away from deep, like really focus on covering the 3-ball, and if they are going to pick and roll you to death all night, at that point you're still at least trading 2s for 2s instead of 3s for 2s. So I do think I would probably put them above, I'd put them above the Clippers, and it would be really close for me to the Spurs, honestly, because I, you know, we'll talk about the Spurs next, but I also have some concerns about a few of their defensive matchups in the playoffs. So at that, you know, with that in mind, it's like I have more faith in Houston's offense than I do in San Antonio's. So for me, gun to my head, I would probably put Houston number two in the West right now, but I have also been irrationally high on them all year. So just because a 40-game sample size has me looking smart does not mean the next 40-game sample size will do the same. So let's turn to your Spurs, Sarah. You know, surprise, surprise, Tim Duncan retired, and they're still on pace to win 50 games, always. Kawhi Leonard, you wrote an article about him a couple months ago about why he is not a system player. Turns out you were right. He is very much not a system player. He had a 30-point game on Thursday, which, according to ESPN Stats and Info, that was his 10th game this season with at least 30 points. He only had four such games in his first five seasons combined. So for those who do not believe Kawhi Leonard is a superstar, open your goddamn eyes. He is. Tony Parker, Pau Gasol, and LaMarcus Aldridge, all three were somewhat inconsistent to start the year. Seems like each of them is rounding into form and getting more comfortable. I mean, Pau, offensively at least, I know he's been putting up some pretty good numbers lately. And Danny Green, you know, he was the giant question mark last year. Everyone was like, "What? How did he forget to shoot?" Turns out he didn't forget to shoot. He's back well north of 40%. So he is providing that same, you know, 3-and-D look that he did throughout the Spurs championship run and run in the finals a couple of years ago. So, Sarah, I mean, you already said, you know, you think you would have them number two in the West. So do you think, matchup-wise, you think they're the biggest threat to the Warriors? And do you see Pop doing anything special with their playoff rotation, particularly against Golden State? Do you think he's worried about how Parker, Gasol, and Aldridge will fare against the Warriors in that regard?
I think it's, you know, fair to say that probably every coach is worried about how they're going to defend those guys. You know, usually when I think Pop is going to zig, he zags, so I won't try to, you know, attempt to figure out what he's going to do or anticipate what he's going to do, but I honestly think Davis Bertans is a wild card there. You know, and I don't know, because he's so young, I'm not sure what kind of playoff minutes he's going to see, but I do think in certain matchups he could be really crucial. Same thing with Deadman. But Kawhi Leonard is so freaking good. It's ridiculous. You mentioned the 30-point. He just had two 30-pointers in a row, and it was like, it looked so easy, mm-hmm. you know. And he's doing it in limited minutes. Like, last night he had 14 points in the first quarter. I look up early in the third, and he's at 27, and I felt like he hadn't even done anything much since the first, you know. Right. But I was also busy during the game. But it's like, geez. He's got 31, and I don't even think he played the last 3 minutes of the third quarter and none of the fourth. So, you know. These people who still say, well, he's never had 40 or 50. It's like, he could have had 40 easy.
Yeah.
You know? Easy. But anyway, I digress. As for the Warriors, I mean, we'll get into them in a minute. I do think, more so than in past years, teams with especially, like, two really good bigs, so like Memphis, even to an extent Utah, can hurt them, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's not a gaping vulnerability, because right. they're still so potent. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, we've talked about that before. Pau does look really good right now offensively, but yeah, you worry about what you're giving up on the other end. It'll be interesting. I do think the Spurs have a good mixture of people to try and throw at the Warriors. Like you said, you've got Deadman, you've got Pau. This is kind of the yin and the yang.
Yeah, right.
And Deadman also is, you know, it's the first time in a long time that the Spurs have had a guy that you can just kind of throw it up to, alley-oop it to, and he's a threat in that way that we haven't had in forever. So it's going to be interesting. If Spurs are going to be, a team that goes to the third round and possibly the finals, it's going to come down to, you know, guys like Jonathan Simmons that, you know, haven't really been that far on that stage yet. The Spurs are going to depend a lot on guys like that, so it's really a toss-up. We'll just have to see how they perform in the playoffs.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Simmons, Dedmon. Patty Mills also stands out as a guy to me. Like, I kind of think he's going to be their X factor in determining, you know, in a hypothetical Spurs-Warriors series. I just don't see how Tony Parker is going to keep up with Steph. And maybe you put Danny Green on him. I feel like Kawhi's got to be on Durant. Have to, you know, you don't really have a choice in that. So you need to probably put Danny on Steph and then let Clay have more or less free reign, at least in terms of, like, not being covered by one of your top two defenders. But, you know, if for whatever reason Pop just goes straight covers and does Parker on Curry, I don't see any way that works long term. So I feel like in that sense, Patty Mills might see a little bit more playing time than usual, and maybe he's kind of the Curry stopper, and you do Mills on Curry, Green on Thompson, Kawhi on Durant, and that gives you a fighting chance, defensively at least. But, you know, I think that's going to be the big question with the Spurs for the next 3 months. We know they're good. We know they're going to be a 50-win team. They're going to be in the playoffs. They're going to probably be a top three seed, maybe even top two. The question is, you know, when they're going against these offensively potent teams, how do they cover up these three guys who are not necessarily, if they're not defensive minuses, they are not defensive pluses either. They're, you know, average or worse defensively. I don't think there's any easy way to answer that question right now. And I think it'll be matchup dependent, obviously. It depends on...
We should mention that they were briefly the top defensive team in the league. I think they're still, like, they slipped to number two. I'm not sure where they are now. So they're defending well somehow. Mm-hmm. But they do have, you know, weak areas like every team. But, sure, you know, the pick and roll is a struggle at times. Yeah. They're going to have to figure out. I think the Bucks, and Powell even mentioned after the Bucks game they lost narrowly the other day, that the Bucks ran like the same two plays over and over and over. And the Spurs did not have a lot of success stopping it. And it was, a lot of it was like a pick and roll with Beasley, Michael Beasley. Oh, so
yeah.
And that's something they're going to have to address and try to solve in some way before the playoffs come around. Because the Rockets are going to throw that at you a bunch.
Yeah.
The Clippers are going to throw that at you a bunch. Yeah. And, you know, with good old Steph Curry somewhat coaching for Steve Kerr, they're going to run that more. Right. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah. So let's go into Steph Curry and the Warriors right now. You know, last year they won 73 games. This year, probably not going to win 73 again, but at 33-6, they're not very far off from that pace. They have a chance for a statement game Monday against the Cavs, who have kind of hit a rough patch on this West Coast trip. They've been complaining about needing practice to freshen up their sets and get Korver integrated. So this is, you know, the Warriors do not play. They have 3 days of rest before this game. Cavs seem tired and grumpy. So this could be send a statement for that Christmas Day loss. Kevin Durant still putting up MVP caliber numbers. It's basically like he's in OKC still. Steph, he's taken a step back statistically compared to last year, but as he recently told ESPN.com's Chris Haynes, he called it comical, because if you look at the numbers in the politest way, I'll take those slump numbers any day of the week, which is a completely fair point. You know, most teams would kill for a guy putting up the numbers Steph is, even if it's not, you know, 36-5 with 5 3-pointers a game. So that begs the question. I mean, I think both of us, it's safe to say, still thinks the Warriors are the number one team in the West, the biggest threat to come out of the West and go to the finals. So what do you see as the weaknesses on the team that could be exploited come playoff time, if there are any?
Well, everybody's kind of talked about it a little bit. I think you mentioned too in the outline that, you know, that they don't have really as much answer for bigs as they once did. Of course, you know, they didn't play Bogut that many minutes, but yeah, he was still important. Yeah, I think teams have been able to punish them a little bit in the post, which they couldn't do as much in the last couple of years. The bench, it's not going to be a big issue, especially not in the playoffs, but I remember Morton, you know, when he picked them to win, what, 73 or 4 again? Yeah, and he said that they were just going to have such huge leads and then they were going to be able to rest their starters and cruise with the bench. Well, you know, that hasn't happened as much because they do have some turnover there and some younger guys, and you can't just leave those guys in and expect them to hold the huge lead anymore. You know, rotations will shorten in the playoffs, and that won't be as big a deal. I think the Rockets gave a pretty good blueprint in that game in Golden State, that really fun game. They crashed the offensive glass a lot. Mm-hmm. And there again, you have to make sure you have somebody back because that's really dangerous to not. But like Ryan Anderson was all over the offensive glass, and I think that's an interesting strategy as well. Because, you know, the Warriors aren't even a bad rebounding team still somehow, you know, but they can be hurt in that way. Those are the big ones for me. And in their defense, they seem to still be capable of defending well, but it's like, you know, they kind of flip a switch, which we've seen teams do in years past, and that's a dangerous strategy to get into, where you know, it's like they don't care as much at certain times, and then they decide, well, okay, now we're going to defend.
Right.
And I don't think you want to get into that, but at the same time, they're, you know, they're maybe a little more human than they looked last year. It's the same. It's like the same as with Steph. It's like he said, you could say the same thing about the whole team. It's just that he set such a high bar last year that, you know, he looks more human. He looks a little less invincible. But his numbers are still great. The big difference is his off the dribble stuff. That is what really made them transcendent and terrifying last year. He hasn't been quite as great at that, but they're still cruising along, winning most of their games, you know, as usual.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're basically in the top 10, at least, of just about every offensive category imaginable. So any concerns about, like, Kevin Durant, you know, we talked about it coming into the year, how we didn't expect them to struggle like the 2010-11 Miami Heat, because it wasn't like they were putting together an entirely new offense. They were just integrating a four-time scoring champion into an already constructed, you know, team strategy, team culture. Kevin Durant has taken no time to acclimate. He looks great. I think you're right to point out that Curry, you know, is not attacking off the dribble as much as he used to. That said, I think Draymond was the one who said this recently. He basically said, like, for half of each game, we're basically just like experimenting and seeing what works and what doesn't, because we, you know, we do have such a different group now, both with KD and then with a very different bench from the core that they brought to the last two finals. So I think you're right to say that, you know, that bench, that perceived lack of bench depth, probably will not be as much of an issue come playoff time, just because, you know, the guys, KD, Thompson, Curry, Draymond, are each going to be playing minutes in the high 30s. Iggy's probably going to be playing 30 minutes a night. Zaza's minutes are probably going to go up a little bit. Future All-Star Zaza, I should say. So I think, you know, you brought up their bench depth and the rebounding. I think those are definitely two of the biggest ones to watch out for moving forward. We also have to talk about turnovers, because, you know, that...
Exactly, I was just going to say, I forgot that.
Yeah, yep. That's, I mean, that's been their issue. It was their issue last year. It came back to bite them in Game 7 when Steph throws that behind-the-back pass in the fourth quarter that goes out of bounds, and Steve Kerr is about to have an aneurysm. And, you know, They came back to haunt them on Christmas Day against the Cavs. Like, they are just a little too casual with some of these passes, and they try to be a little too flashy. I don't know
what Curry can do to stop doing that.
But I think that's also what makes them so. You know, it's another reason they're so difficult to guard, because when he hits those passes, it's like, those are guaranteed buckets. So it's trying to find a balance there between aggressive and reckless. And most of the time they have that they're pretty set on the aggressive, not reckless side, but then sometimes they go a little too far. So all of these things are very minor nits to pick, frankly. I mean, again, I think we would both, if we had to choose a team to come out of the West today, I think it's safe to say we would both take the Warriors. But, you know, it's just, as you said, they do not look as invincible as they did last year. And, you know, we talked last time about if we were picking a Cleveland Warriors series, it's pretty close right now. It's not, I mean, Cleveland's limp, of course, since we've had that conversation, Cleveland has been limping along for the past week, but... Okay. You know, if assuming full health on both sides, that I think it looks more evenly matched this year than it did last year, despite the Warriors adding KD, as insane as that sounds.
Yeah, it's the thing. Like, theoretically, on paper, they should be more unguardable, but it feels like that's not quite true, you know, at least so far. But they could still get better. But I'm really glad that you brought up, like, the fact that their ball movement is one of the things that made them so dangerous. Because I did see them talking about, you know, that maybe all that beautiful ball movement is a bit of a problem. No, that is the reason that you're no longer losing in the second half of the Spurs, you know, like in 2013. You know, that's not the problem. But you just can't be careless at the same time. It's a delicate balance. They are, like, right now, I think they average like 15 turnovers a game, which is 26th in the league. But at the same time, they're turning over their opponents 15 times. So it's kind of working out for them. I think we should also mention, though, you know, like there again, we figured KD would integrate well, and he has. But like we saw at the end of that Memphis game, they're still trying to figure out when they are in the clutch, which they rarely are because they're so good. You know, how do we execute? Who do we go to? And they pretty clearly had a Steph pick and roll play towards the end of that game set up. And KD had a mismatch, I think, with Zebo, and he called for it. And, you know, that's pretty well documented. You can still go back and find the video on Twitter if you're looking for it. But yeah, Steph ended up giving it to him. He didn't look that happy about giving it to him. Draymond certainly was not happy about it. And, you know, that they are going to have to work that out, or that could be an issue in the playoffs as well.
That's a very good point. I'm glad you brought up that Memphis game, because I was just, like, casually watching it. Like, oh, wait, the Warriors are blowing them out. Oh, wait, this is a game again. Oh, this is fun.
Yeah, I stopped watching, and then I checked my phone later, and it's like, Memphis had won. Right. What? So I luckily was able to go, like, rewind the TV and watch the fourth. But yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, that was a very surprising comeback, to say the least. And Zebo's interview afterwards was fantastic. Okay, so let's now move. We don't have much for our Where Amazing Happened segment this week, but we do have a quick Rajon Rondo update. You know, we talked at length about him last time, so go listen to last week's episode if you want to hear us on Rajon Rondo. This week, since Jimmy Butler has been out with an illness and Wade was out, I think, just with a normal night of rest on Tuesday, Rondo got into the lineup on Tuesday. Before the game, he said he was telling reporters that Fred Hoiberg did not explain why he was benched, but said, quote, "I got a slight explanation from another guy on the staff. A guy told me that he was saving me from myself." He also referred to his benching as bullshit. So that's fun. He also played Thursday night in the loss to the Knicks because, again, the Bulls were shorthanded. Afterward, I think Taj was saying, like, we're a better team with Rondo, and Hoiberg said, yeah, expect him in the lineup moving forward. So all of this is to say the Rajon Rondo drama is nowhere near over. I'm sure once Morton is back from his honeymoon, we can hear from him and see how his thoughts have evolved on Mr. Rondo and his fit with the Bulls. The only other big thing, because we already mentioned KG joining the Clippers, Adrian Wojnarowski of The Vertical broke this news this week that Allen Iverson is going to be a player/coach in the new Big 3 3-on-3 league, which is something sponsored by Ice Cube. It's going to be kind of touring the country this summer. He's joining, according to Woj, joining Chauncey Billups, Kenyon Martin, Rashard Lewis, Jermaine O'Neal, Steven Jackson, and Jason Williams. Just for some background on the league, it's only for ex-professional players above the age of 30. They're going to be played in half-court settings to preserve the guy's legs, basically, and will feature four-point shots designated by three large circles several feet behind the three-point line. They'll be played to 60 points, and there's a 7-minute halftime once the team reaches 30 points. Iverson, when he was at a press conference Wednesday to talk about it, and he said, when I got the call, it was a no-brainer. It's ice. You don't turn that down. That's success looking you right into your eyes. So, Sarah, how excited are you for the Big 3 League?
It's pretty exciting, like, because, first of all, I could watch Jason Williams, you know, tapes of him, like, killing rec leagues, stuff have come out, and, like, I could watch that all day. So that's pretty fun. I was a little worried about the four-point thing because, first of all, none of these guys are really big three-point shooters to begin with, except Jack, sort of, Rashard Lewis a little bit. Chauncey could hit the shot, but, yeah, I don't know how that's going to work out. It's like Greg Popovich's nightmare. Really, but it's exciting. I had flashes in my mind of the XFL, which I'm afraid it'll flame out like that. Hopefully it won't. But it's exciting. I think it has the potential to be really fun.
If nothing else, it'll be some fun thing to track during the NBA offseason. I think it's going from like June until late June until August, I think I saw. I don't know if it's being televised. One can only hope that ESPN is smart enough to know that this is just pure gold. I'm giddy with excitement about Allen Iverson as a player coach. There is no way this does not end just with an epic meltdown at some point. So I'm also excited for, like, 15 years down the line, because this thing is clearly going to work when Steph Curry joins the league and just rains four-pointers on dudes for the rest. Oh, my God. They'll I guess it's a half-court game anyway, so he'll just walk three steps, stand in that circle, and shoot. It's going to be great. So, keep an eye out, everyone, for the Big 3, 3-on-3 league. We will present more details when they announce more, because obviously it's a fun chance to catch up with some former NBA stars. I'm hoping Stephon Marbury seems like a lock for this, right? He's got to come back from China.
He should be.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, so maybe. Oh, I guess.
But he runs China, so.
Yeah, I don't know. They have like built statues in his honor at this point, so maybe he doesn't come back. Maybe Shaq, maybe this. They should frankly get the inside the NBA guys. Like, we need Shaq and Barkley and Kenny the Jet to come out and make their own 3-on-3 team. That would be unstoppable. All right, I just got an idea. I'm going to go sponsor one of these things when I'm done. So let's finish up this week with our crushes of the week. We are going to, as always, shine a spotlight on a player who deserves a little more recognition than he's getting nationally. So, Sarah, who's your crush of the week?
Well, I cheated a little bit because I picked Danny Green last time, but I didn't really mention the contest, so I would just like to cape for him right now to be in the three-point contest. He's not only shooting a career best for the three-point percentage, but he's currently leading the league So this is his year to get the invite. I feel bad because I've been waiting for it to happen, you know, and it just kind of never worked out because they were never going to pick two Spurs, even though, you know, they have no problem. They don't hesitate to pick two Warriors, of course. I get it. But, yeah, you know, Bellinelli had his year. Bonner, well-deserved. All these guys, well-deserved. You know, and then finally, actually, Danny was really good, I think, at 15 as well, but didn't get it. Last year, obviously, had a down year, but this is his time, dang it, and he better get an invite. I need to see Danny Green in the three-point contest this year. Invite whoever else you want, all the Splash Brothers, the third Splash Brother, I don't care, just invite Danny Green, please.
That caping is allowed, because I'm going to... Lloyd knows that I will be caping for Mr. Embiid to be in the All-Star game in a few minutes. Before we go there, though, you reminded me, thankfully, that you had nominated Malcolm Brogdon a couple weeks ago as your crush, so I will not do him again, even though he's been playing out of his freaking mind since moving into the Bucks starting lineup at his first career triple-double on New Year's Eve. I think it's safe to say that the Bucks have the steal of the draft already. Kid was a second round pick, mm-hmm. and looks like a legitimate, at least rotation player, if nothing else, but a legitimate keeper in that young core in Milwaukee. I'm writing something for B-Ball Breakdown right now about kind of the best young cores in the league, and I think Milwaukee has the best one. Once I write this thing, we can argue about it next week, but... I think the Giannis, Jabari, Chris Middleton gives them the best big three, but then with Brogdon as well, it's just another fun young piece to add to that team. So keep an eye out for the Bucks; they're going to be really good. You know, the fact they've stayed this good without Middleton this year is terrifying, frankly. So shout out to Morton too, because he's the only one I think of us who put the Bucks in the playoffs heading into the year. But my actual crush of the week, Tyreke Evans. He missed the first 26 games because he had, I think, three knee procedures in the last 18 months. So he was coming back from that. He's still working his way back slowly. He's been on a minutes limit. They've been gradually ramping him up. They've given him, he started in like the 12 to 15 minute range. He's now moving up to around, I think, 18 to 20. Against Brooklyn on Thursday, though, he played nearly 28 minutes, had a season-high 29 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists, 4 steals, and a block, I believe. Yeah, he had a block, too, and 2 threes as well. So, just wanted to shout out Tyreke for getting healthy. It's, it's fun seeing him back on the court. We talked about the Pelicans earlier. It's sad to see Anthony Davis on a team where he was just putting up 40-point 20 rebound games earlier this season, and they were still losing. So it's nice to see the Pelicans finally getting healthy, having reinforcements for him, and keep an eye on them. They could be a sneaky contender for that number 8 seed in the West, the factory of sadness that is the number 8 seed. So with Tyreke healthy, with Drew Holiday healthy, knock on wood, everyone in New Orleans, could be an interesting race in the coming months. So that is going to do it this week for the NBA podcast. Again, be sure to check us out on Twitter at the NBA Pod. All three of our Twitter handles are in the bio, so give us a follow as well. You can find us on iTunes. Be sure there to download, to subscribe, to leave us some reviews. We'd love any feedback you have for us. And follow FanRag Sports at FanRag Sports on Twitter and at FanRag NBA for their NBA content. Also, be sure to vote NBA vote Joel Embiid for the All-Star game. He's only 16,000 votes behind Kevin Love, people. We really need him to get that date with Rihanna. He's playing his mind out. He worked Kristaps Porzingis like a little schoolgirl the other night. So be sure. Hashtag NBA vote Joel Embiid. With that said, I am Brian Toporek. I was joined, as always, by Sarah Chalea. Sarah, great talking to you.
You too.
All right, take care.
You too, bud.